This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We're the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, updates on the EpiPen saga, the FCC's municipal broadband initiative, and major regulatory action threatens a for-profit college. All that economic news coming up in the People's Bulletin.
And more bad news for the private prison industry, which is good news for everyone else. The Department of Homeland Security is now examining whether or not it wants to do business with for-profit jailers that are currently raking in billions in taxpayer money.
And we talk about the Justice Department's recent filings declaring bail practices unconstitutional. Karen Dolan, an Institute of Policy Studies fellow and the director of its Criminalization of Poverty Project, joins us to discuss.
But first, before we get to all of that, you know, Sam, I relish any opportunity I get on this show to talk about my fantasy sports teams.
You do?
By the way, my fantasy baseball team, the DC Bernie Bergs, are clinging to a first place position by just the slimmest of margins right now, thanks to the stellar bats of Mookie Betts. But I also had my fantasy football draft this weekend.
Oh?
You know, the trolls, they tune into this show to expect us, like, to spew propaganda or support Trump. And here I am talking about my fantasy sports teams. But yeah, I had my fantasy football draft this weekend, and although I didn't draft Colin Kaepernick at quarterback, mainly because he doesn't play and he's bad at football, I sort of wish I did draft him because I gained a lot new respect for the guy over the weekend. Now, I'm sure you've all heard of this controversy wherein Kaepernick, a backup quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, refused to stand during the playing of the national anthem before a preseason football game. And not an actual game, a preseason game of all things. Not that that matters. Kaepernick said, quote, "I am not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color." This is why he explained why he didn't stand. He added, quote, "To me, this is bigger than football, and it would be selfish on my part to look the other way. There are bodies in the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder." He added, quote, "If they take football away, my endorsements from me, I know that I stood up for what is right." Now, a lot of people, as you can probably imagine, haven't taken too kindly to Kaepernick's act of dissent here. In fact, check out the latest episode of Capital Fight Club, a weekly podcast that Sam and I do with our libertarian friends over at Conservative Review, where we debate the stories of the week, and you'll hear from a couple people who don't like Kaepernick and think that what he's doing by not standing for the national anthem is awful. Also, there's a former teammate of Kaepernick's, Alex Boone, who spoke out in the press. He now plays for the Minnesota Vikings. And he said, quote, "That flag obviously gives Kaepernick the right to do whatever he wants. I understand it. At the same time, you should have some effing respect for people who served, especially people that lost their life to protect our freedom." There were also videos all over the internet of football fans burning their Colin Kaepernick jersey. Even weenie DC journalists got their punches in on Kaepernick. The Washington Post's Chris Saliza, you know, the fix, he tweeted out, quote, "If you don't stand during God Bless America during a baseball game, you and I are unlikely to be friends," which actually is a huge benefit to whoever doesn't like standing during the song, because nobody wants to be friends with Chris Saliza anyway. Seriously.
Yeah, I was going to say the flip side of that is that if you take the Twitter to say that people who don't stand up for God Bless America, if you say that those people shouldn't be your friend by saying that, you know, I don't want to be your friend. So
yeah.
So thanks for saving me the trouble, Chris Saliza.
Yeah, seriously.
I'm pretty sure I didn't want to be friends with Chris Saliza before this.
Not just you, not just me. Seriously, Chris, no one wants to be your friend. Are we bullying Chris Saliza right now?
I don't know.
Anyways, look, there's like four different jingoistic military ceremonies that people have to follow the rules to when they go to a sporting event nowadays in the United States. There's God Bless America before the game, the national anthem before the game, in a few innings, they do a special salute to the troops.
And oftentimes, at least here in Washington, D.C., those salutes to the troops are sponsored by defense contractors.
Yes, they are. And we'll get to some of that here in a little bit. And but all of these display, these ceremonies, they're just freaking weird. Is it necessary to pay tribute to the country and to the military before and during every single sporting event in the U.S.? It gives me the same creepy feeling that forcing kids in public school around the country to recite a Pledge of Allegiance to a flag gives me. I remember by high school, like, they kind of stopped enforcing that. If you were a senior in high school, you could just ignore it, and most teachers didn't care anymore. But in elementary school, you stand up or you're shamed. And you know that if other countries were doing this, if other countries forced or encouraged their citizenry, from school children on up to adults attending sports games, to recite oaths every day to the state, we'd all think that that was weird as hell. I can imagine the Daily Beast and the BuzzFeed writing articles like, those backwards Iranians or those strange Russians forced to pledge allegiance to the Kremlin every single day. What's up with that? Yet it's exactly what we do here, all over the country, every time a bunch of jocks step onto a court or onto a grassy field, or whenever kids start their day in elementary school. And let me tell you, as Kaepernick is finding out, you really are shamed if you don't act in complete accordance with the rules society has dictated on how to act during these nationalistic pledges and songs. Remember what happened to U.S. gymnast Gabby Douglas a few weeks ago when she stood but didn't put her hand over her heart, which seems a little excessive to me, but not for the nationalistic nutcases out there. You need to put your hand over your heart or else you don't care about the U.S. They gave her hell online and in the media for days. I've had it happen to me before, obviously for different reasons than Douglas was harangued, mainly, I believe, because she was black. Also worth noting, Kaepernick is biracial. But I stood for the national anthem at a Nats game a few months ago, but forgot to take my hat off. And boy, was that a mistake. I was immediately accosted by someone who said I was being extremely disrespectful. Really? That's funny, because I'm not the one walking up to complete strangers trying to fight them because they didn't take their dang hats off. Seriously, people. At the very least, they need to chill out about this. And they need to mind their own damn business when the national anthem is on, or the Pledge of Allegiance, or God Bless America. Remember when those college-age Clinton supporters wrote those op-eds about how pressured they feel on college campuses to speak out in favor of Hillary Clinton? And that they're being silenced? Those articles were dumb, and the main reason why people were too afraid to speak out is because they didn't care that much to speak out. But I'll tell you, you want to know what peer pressure really looks like? Go to a sporting event with a bunch of red-blooded Americans and choose to sit during the national anthem. People will try to fight you. So maybe don't do what I just said, because they will. I don't want the responsibility for people getting beaten up at sporting events. And really, I don't think Kaepernick was necessarily trying to be an activist or trying, you know, to make a big stand here by not standing. He made a personal decision. He went, he sat down, and then he explained his reasoning when he was asked about it. And he said he'll keep sitting down unless things in the country improve. And he didn't make up any problems with the U.S. You know, he didn't lodge any complaints that aren't unfounded, that people aren't aware of already. He very clearly detailed what he said was wrong with the country and why he's not standing up, which is that, quote, there are bodies in the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder. And we know this. We know that there is a problem with people, particularly unarmed people of color, being killed by police officers in the U.S. It's happened 990 times this year already. And we know that in most cases, the officer gets paid time off while prosecutors decide to press charges, which they almost never, ever do. And as we saw in Baltimore, when they do press charges, it is extremely hard to convict those police officers. And we know that citizens have been organizing and marching and pressuring the media and politicians to do something about this issue, to affirm that Black Lives Matter and to make changes to back up that affirmation. Changes like appointing independent prosecutors to investigate each police shooting, having the Department of Justice collect more data on police shootings, require better training for police officers. And we know that Trump voter and Fox News viewer aside, these calls for justice have been met by reasonable people with sympathy. We recognize that this is a problem in our country. Our athletes and movie stars and politicians have all spoken up about it. So I don't understand all the controversy around this Kaepernick thing. He's just adding his voice to promoting the issue as well. And he's inspired others, too. On Monday, Eagles linebacker Mike Tavares announced he would follow Kaepernick's lead when the team plays their final preseason game later this week, and he'll sit down during the national anthem. "We've got that right," Tavares said. "There's just a lot going on that people don't want to talk about, and I feel like us as athletes were looked at as role models, and I feel like with Colin Kaepernick, he's doing a great job for standing up in what he believes in, and most people may not like that, but that's his opinion. He's entitled to it, and I respect him for doing it," Tavares said. Beyond just letting people process these national anthems any damn way they please, because they have a right to do that, can we just strip some of the sanctimony around these militaristic displays of patriotism away? Sports teams and leagues aren't doing them out of the goodness of their heart or because they really do like the United States and they support the troops. They're doing this stuff because they get paid to do them. They get paid a lot, in fact, by the U.S. military using taxpayer dollars. Last May, NewJersey.com reported that 14 professional football teams had received more than $5 million from the Department of Defense to hold patriotic displays during football games. And also last year, Republican Senators Jeff Flake and John McCain released a report showing that the Pentagon dished out $7 million over the last few years, paying professional sports teams for public tributes to the military. In one example of the arrangement, the Pentagon paid the NFL's Atlanta Falcons to recognize wounded warriors and have a National Guard member sing the national anthem. In another case, the New York Jets were paid $20,000 to honor New Jersey's National Guard members at every single home game. And in another contract, the Department of Defense paid the Major League Baseball team, the Milwaukee Brewers, $49,000 to sponsor performances of God Bless America. Senator McCain said in a statement alongside the release of the report, quote, "Americans across the country should be deeply disappointed that many of the ceremonies honoring troops at professional sporting events are not actually being conducted out of a sense of patriotism, but for profit in the form of millions in taxpayer dollars going from the Department of Defense to wealthy pro sports franchises." He added, "Fans should have confidence that their hometown heroes are being honored because of their honorable military service, not as a marketing ploy." But as this information shows, that's not the case. But by all means, let's make sure everybody pays their due respect to the military show that's being put on by the sports team because they're being paid to do it. Give me a break.
One thing that's troubling to me about this is how the very singing of the national anthem itself, the Star Spangled Banner itself, is steeped in basically militarist and authoritarian traditions, authoritarian ideology.
Yeah.
The first major sporting event to feature the national anthem was before it was the national anthem. The Star Spangled Banner became the national anthem in 1932. But anyway, the first major sporting event to feature the song was the 1918 World Series in Chicago just after the First World War during the first Red Scare. The day before the game, the Chicago Federal Building had been bombed, killing 4 and injuring 30. the industrial workers of the world were blamed for the attack in retaliation for World War I related sedition charges, though no one was ever convicted. Surprise, surprise. And during the seventh inning stretch at that game between the Cubs and the Yankees, the song was played at Wrigley Field, eliciting a patriotic fervor, marking the start of the new tradition.
Maybe that's why the Cubs have never won a World Series since then.
Yeah, well,
payback.
Well, during the Second World War, it was made much more of a stronger tradition. And, you know, I guess at wartime, it kind of made sense, especially because a lot of baseball players went to go fight, most famously Ted Williams.
Yeah.
You know, but it was kept around, and scrapping it would have been basically politically impossible amid the Cold War, especially after the McCarthy era and the second Red Scare. So, and since then, as you've noted, we've only seen, you know, American nationalists try to add to the jingoistic confessionalism at sporting events, salute to the troops, multiple times per games, God bless America during the seventh inning stretch, Air Force flyovers. It's really all too much. You know, I can see maybe like a few times a year doing like honoring the troops.
Even as you mentioned on our podcast earlier, at the World Cup, where you're competing against other countries, and there is this sense of nationalism.
Oh, no, that makes sense. Exactly. Yeah. An international competition.
But
absolutely.
Here, when you have two United States teams playing each other, it just seems all a bit excessive.
Yeah, I will say this for Kaepernick. Congratulations to him for making preseason football relevant.
Yes. Nice work, Colin. More unanimous dissent coming up. Welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you and still broadcasting from Washington, D.C.
Earlier this month, in a case before a federal appeals court in Atlanta, a third-party briefing filed by the Justice Department garnered national attention amid the debate over criminal justice reform. Maurice Walker, a man in his mid-50s suffering from schizophrenia, who was arrested for public drunkenness and then kept in bars for 6 days because he couldn't afford $160 in bail, he sued the city of Calhoun, Georgia, saying its policies were unconstitutional. In January, a federal judge agreed, and now the case is before the 11th Circuit Federal Appeals Court. And it was in this case that the DOJ turned heads when on August 18th it filed a friend of the court or amicus brief calling fixed bail unconstitutional. Bail practices that incarcerate indigent individuals before trial solely because of their inability to pay for their release violate the 14th Amendment, the department said in its filing, referring to the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. At any point in time, by the way, according to the UK-based International Center for Prison Studies, there are about 480,000 people in local jails in the United States awaiting to be processed by the legal system. Last week, we spoke to Karen Dolan to discuss this issue more. Karen is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington, D.C., and the director of its Criminalization of Poverty program, and she reached us by phone. Karen, I want to get your reaction to the DOJ filing in this case before the 11th Circuit. Did it surprise you? And what impact do you think it will have, if any?
I think it's a very important ruling, a very important directive. It wasn't necessarily surprising. In one way, some ways it is, and in other ways it isn't. The Justice Department has been very vocal on its opposition to money bail system. It has been something they've been focused on. They have been listening to advocates who oppose this regressive system of targeting poor people and people of color and the disproportionate impacts on those populations. So it isn't a new position for the Department of Justice, but it is a very strong move. It's a very bold move, one that's very welcome for the Department of Justice to issue such strong language.
And can you talk broadly about how bail works, sort of, for those fortunate enough to have never been arrested or had a family member arrested?
Well, the way bail works in more modern times here in the U.S. is that people who have been arrested but before trial, especially for misdemeanor crimes, can be offered bail so that they don't have to spend the time in detention leading up to a trial. And so this is a refundable money. It's sort of money that kind of you pay to the court, and then when you go to trial, it's returned. It's an insurance policy, in a sense, so that people don't skip out on the trial and end up not showing up to court. So that's supposed to be the reasoning behind it. I think the history goes back to more verbal agreements, and then they became monetized in more modern times.
I wanted to bring this up really quickly. There was a recent study, It was investigative reporting by the Huffington Post, which found that, bail practices really is a matter of life and death for a lot of people. And I'm just going to read this really quickly. This was by Ryan Riley in his report on the DOJ bail directive. Bail practices in the United States often leave poor people languishing in jail simply because they cannot afford a certain amount of money to purchase their freedom. Many of the more than 800 jail deaths logged by the Huffington Post between July 2015 and July 2016 involved individuals who were incarcerated after being arrested for minor offenses and who were unable to afford their bail. What are some other ways that we see bail practices, I suppose less dramatic than that, but what are some other examples of bail stories or bail trends that people should pay attention to or people should worry about?
Well, I think that points at it. So usually this disproportionately impacts people who don't have the ability to pay bail. And in some cases, a bail bondsman, they'll pay a certain percentage of it, and then they're indebted to this profiteer for years. And the reason that they have to pay a bail bondsman in the first place is because they can't afford the bail. So the overwhelming majority of people who are either participating in the bail system or languishing in jail pre-trial because they can't afford bail are very poor people. I think the estimate is something like $15,000 a year or less income. So even what some people may consider a modest bail is impossible for many of these people. And so if you are already just living paycheck to paycheck, or you have some of these debts, or you're paying child support, or you're a single parent, or you have a minimum wage job without benefits and leave, or any number of things, or having to pay your rent. If you are either having to come up with a large amount of money for bail or a large amount of money to pay a bail bondsman and then subsequently payments to that bail bondsman for years, or you're in jail and unable to work, you can lose your job, you can lose your home, you can lose custody of your children. Just completely devastating. And it's devastating to the very people who have the least ability to recover from it. And this is, remember, pre-trial. This is before you've even, whether your innocence or your guilt has been proven. So your guilt is really assumed under this system. And again, it is a system that impacts people with the least ability to pay. So that is the objection from the Department of Justice and many advocates, that it really amounts to debtors' prisons or jailing people simply because of their indigence.
My colleague Sam is going to jump in just a second, but I just wanted to point out that in this case that the DOJ filed their briefing in, the man who was arrested, who's now the plaintiff in this case, Maurice Walker, he was arrested for public drunkenness. And so that apparently was enough to keep him behind bars for 6 days because he didn't have $160. And he's also mentally ill as well. So another example of how the most vulnerable, I guess, are impacted most.
That's right.
Karen, we saw Attorney General Lynch a few months ago give a speech on the criminalization of poverty. And she was talking about policies, I guess, that are running parallel to this problem with bail. And that is huge fines for tickets and then fines on top of tickets when people can't pay them. This was a big problem in Ferguson. And we know that at the same time, a lot of these police departments depend on these sort of tickets and these fines that they charge people for actual funding of their operations. Can you talk about the connection between the two, how police departments fund themselves now and how that's problematic when it comes to criminalizing people who tend to be poor, overcharging the poor, or funding departments, I guess, on the backs of citizens they police?
Well, right. It's sort of a vicious cycle, and one that state and local governments are being particularly stupid about fiscally and otherwise, even regardless of the fact that it's a complete injustice. It's also fiscally unsustainable. So as we have increased our massive incarceration of people, mostly poor people and people of color, the burden on state and localities for these services and for the prison facilities and, you know, the burden of their own over-policing and over-incarceration has increased costs in conjunction with, especially since the recession, these austerity measures from Congress. So you've got less revenue sharing between the federal government and states and localities, and you have cuts to estate tax, and you have all kinds of changes and reductions in services and revenue sharing with localities. So places like Ferguson and places with a high population of low-income people don't have the property taxes, for instance, to bolster the squeeze in those budgets. And so their costs are climbing and their budgets are reducing. And what they're doing is increasing fines and fees massively and increasing policing. So you've got this vicious cycle, and you're trying to get the money out of the people who don't have it. And in many cases, when they don't have the money, as in the case not just of pretrial detention, but also of incarceration and over-incarceration for lesser and lesser crimes, you have an unsustainable financial situation because people can't pay these prices.
Karen, you mentioned debtors' prisons. The concept of debtors' prisons, they're supposed to be unconstitutional in this country, if I understand correctly. And of course, there are all sorts of laws that are supposed to protect people's due process and civil rights. And on top of that, you have civil rights laws and anti-discrimination laws that are designed to sort of prevent policies that disproportionately impact in a negative way communities of color. Why have all these safeguards? Where have all these safeguards been? I guess, is my question.
Well, one of the problems is that these oversight and regulations and so-called laws and policies are specific to municipalities. And so you're not supposed to jail somebody for being indigent or not having enough money to pay, but there aren't enforceable standards by which a judge determines someone's ability to pay. So what's been happening increasingly is that a judge will just use their own subjective determination as to whether or not somebody can pay and may make erroneous decisions on that, and or when a person is unable to pay due to very, you know, strict and more strict processes for paying, as we saw in Ferguson, where you couldn't pay part of a fine or you had to pay all of it within a very short amount of time. So as these things increase, people will end up not being able to make the payments on time or not being able to make the payments at all. Or we saw in Ferguson as well that the time the court was open was, you know, just a few amount of hours, and they wouldn't accept children and all kinds of restrictions that make it hard for people both to pay and also sometimes even to show up for their court dates. So what ends up happening is that they have contempt of court. They're found in contempt of court and jailed for that reason. So combined with the fact that a judge is making a subjective judgment on a person's ability to pay, and combined with all of the obstacles to be able to be in compliance with the law, you can see people jailed for these reasons. So although the reason given isn't inability to pay, in effect, that is the reason.
We're entering just the final few months of President Obama's term, and we've seen his Justice Department make some interesting steps, including this one in regard to bail. We saw just a few weeks ago their decision to start cutting ties with private prisons, at least in the federal incarceration system. We've had these slew of reports from various communities, from Ferguson to Cleveland to Baltimore, outlining several problems that these communities have with police. I'm wondering if you are anticipating any more moves on certain issues in the Department of Justice, or are looking for the Department of Justice to do anything else in these last few months to, I guess, improve things in lieu of any actual legislation coming out to address criminal justice reform. in these issues?
Well, I think they're doing it, you know, a good amount in terms of what they can do symbolically at the federal level. Of course, most prisoners are not held at the federal level, and private prisons are not in the federal level. And, you know, they have gotten rid of solitary confinement for juveniles held in federal detention, and most juveniles are not held in federal detention. I think that there are other issues coming down the pipe in terms of reentry programs, second chance program, trying to lift some of the barriers to reentering after one is released from incarceration, and job training and those kinds of services that would help with reentry, banning the box so that people don't have to declare a criminal past for incarceration of misdemeanors, those kinds of things. But even though they are, you know, at the federal level where most of the prisoners are not being held, I think it's a very strong, bold statement that will have an effect on all of these different policies at the state and local level, especially if the Justice Department continues along this route as we enter into a new administration. So it's very encouraging to see. There are some people who will say it's, you know, too little too late, which is also true. And these are reform issues. We must also remember, really, if we want to end the problems with pretrial detention, with a money bail system, with over-incarceration, over-policing, increase in fines and fees, we have to stop arresting so many people. And we have to have a different kind of, a more fair, progressive taxation system so that communities aren't pressed to try to make budget shortfalls on the backs of poor people. There's a lot of fundamental changes that have to happen. So in some ways, a lot of this is window dressing. But it's better to have this than to not have it. But we don't want to lose sight of the fact that we incarcerate too many people in this country, that it's overwhelmingly poor, overwhelmingly Black, and fundamentally unjust.
Well, Karen, we're fresh out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Karen is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington, D.C., and the director of its Criminalization of Poverty program. And you can follow her on Twitter at Karen Dolan. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
More Unanimous Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you. Still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel News Team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. All right, I got two stories coming up here for you, and they will be transmitted straight into your dome via a classified session.
We need to get into classified session.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. So as we've noted before on the show, the Department of Homeland Security is currently considering whether or not to classify U.S. election systems as, quote, critical infrastructure in order to ward off potential cyber attacks that could harm the integrity of elections. Well, the hackers aren't waiting around on the department to make this decision. They've already started exploiting the many weaknesses in local election systems. Yahoo News is reporting that the FBI sent an alert this month to state officials warning them to examine their systems for malicious actors following the hack of two state board of elections databases. Bureau sources confirmed to Yahoo News that voter databases in Illinois and Arizona had been compromised by hackers who are believed to be foreign. According to the Illinois Board of Election General Counsel, the state had to shut down its voter registration systems for 10 days last month after the hackers stole the personal data of nearly 200,000 voters. Officials say a similar attempt was made against the Arizona systems, but no data was exfiltrated. In its bulletin to the states, the FBI called on local officials to keep an eye on 8 separate IP addresses that are believed to be associated with the attacks, including one that was used in both cyber intrusions. Quote, the FBI is requesting that states contact their Board of Elections and determine if any similar activity is on their logs, both inbound and outbound, that's been detected. What the FBI memo read. It also added that attempts should not be made to touch or ping the IP addresses directly. Look, we've long known that voting systems are vulnerable to breaches, mainly because there are like 9,000 different jurisdictions when it comes to overseeing U.S. elections, and nearly each jurisdiction has their own way of doing things, their own way of recording the vote and tabulating the vote. And that's essentially why Jay Johnson has acknowledged that it'll be pretty hard to add blanket federal cybersecurity protections to voting by making it, quote, critical infrastructure. And again, critical infrastructure is what the Department of Homeland Security classifies certain important industries to U.S. national and economic security, things like chemical manufacturing plants, transportation systems, communication systems, big, heavy industries like you would expect. Also, things like sporting complexes and casinos and hotels are also considered critical infrastructure, and they receive added federal cybersecurity protection. But elections don't. Voting machines, which are known to be easily hackable, which up until last year, for example, the state of Virginia recalled tons of voting machines, thousands of voting machines, because of how easily hackable they were. Those were in use, by the way, for more than a decade until they were finally recalled. So it seems a little odd that that the critical infrastructure tag has not been extended to such important systems like our election machines. Though I will say the way this election is going, with one candidate harping on about how it's going to be rigged and heightened anxiety that foreign powers are actually trying to rig it, if Homeland Security was ever going to beef up U.S. election cybersecurity, this year would definitely be the time to do it. Now, speaking of the Department of Homeland Security, it may soon be following the Department of Justice's lead, and it might reconsider its use of private prisons. On Monday, Jay Johnson instructed the department's advisory counsel, Judge William Webster, to create a subcommittee to, quote, review DHS's current policy and practices concerning the use of private immigration detention and evaluate whether this practice should be eliminated. You might remember 2 weeks ago, the Justice Department announced it would try to wind down its contracts with private prisons. Currently, the for-profit industry maintains 13 DOJ prisons across the country. That decision sent private prison stocks plummeting, the most well-known of which, the Corrections Corporation of America, shed nearly 40% of its stock value in just one day of trading. And by the way, it's now being sued by investors who claim they were misled about just how valuable the company was in the first place. But this private prison industry did have its relationship with the Department of Homeland Security to fall back on, where it maintains immigration detention centers to hold people caught trying to sneak into the U.S. Corrections Corporation of America gained $689 million from immigrations and customs enforcement contracts since 2008. That made up 23% of its total revenue from federal contracts. The company is actually currently managing a facility for Central American women and children in Texas right now that were detained in Texas. The GEO Group, another private prison company, earned $1.18 billion from contracts with ICE since 2008. Both companies, by the way, also contract with state and local prison systems. So the Department of Justice announcement to cut ties with private prisons was sort of a big deal, but it didn't cut down on the bulk majority of business that the private prison companies do with the U.S. government. Now, the DHS counsel has until November 30th to deliver a recommendation to Jay Johnson on how to move forward in its dealings with the private prison industry. So stay tuned for that. Now on to some economic news for the 99%.
Home Street! High Street! Home Street! High Street! Home Street! High Street!
Well, there are more updates to bring listeners in the EpiPen saga. The company that makes the device used to treat severe allergic reactions has announced that it will put out a generic version. Mylan said that the knockoff EpiPen will cost $300, about half of what the current devices cost.
By the way, some of the reporting on this has noted, though, that with the generic drug, Mylan won't have to give as much of a kickback to pharmacy managers and may actually end up turning a bigger profit than with the non-generic brand. So every good deed gets rewarded there. Huh?
How about that? So the price of EpiPen, as you might recall, has increased by over 400% since 2007 when Mylan purchased the rights to make and produce the contraption. But now hopefully we'll get a generic. So recent reporting on the price hikes obviously have caused a firestorm here in Washington. Lawmakers and Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton have fiercely criticized the company. Senator Amy Klobuchar, the Democrat from Minnesota, for example, asked the Federal Trade Commission to investigate, revealing that she buys EpiPen for her daughter, who suffers from life-threatening allergies. And on the other side of the coin, there is also political family intrigue. In the Senate, Mylan CEO Heather Bresch is the daughter of West Virginia Democrat Senator Joe Manchin. And some news, by the way, to report about Bresch, too. Last week, it came out that her salary had increased to $18.9 million from $2.5 million between 2007 and 2015, the time frame that the price of EpiPen and other Mylan drugs started their steady climb. Well, over the weekend, it was reported by The Guardian that Bresch sold $5 million worth of Mylan stock on August 9th.
Cha-ching!
Just days before the controversy exploded, weeks after the first EpiPen stories appeared, a series of stories that, quote, caused the Mylan share price to drop from $49 on the 18th of August to $42.91 on the 26th of August.
It makes you wonder if people who are getting ready to report on this story had contacted the company in the days beforehand for like a quote or something, and that might have tipped off Bresch that there might be bad news coming down the pike.
She sold her shares about a month after the Wells Fargo analysis came out, which has been cited in a lot of reporting on this.
Yeah.
You know,
she saw the writing on the wall, maybe.
There had been a Slate story that had come out. So, yeah.
No one reads that, though. So.
True. It was absolutely public knowledge. Information about the August 9th stock sale was obtained by The Guardian through the filing of forms by Bresch, which are designed to prevent insider trading by executives. But as we both discussed and as the paper said, there's no indication of legal wrongdoing on the insider trading front.
She still, by the way, holds 800,000 shares.
Exactly, exactly. The Guardian noted that Bresch did not need insider information to know that trouble laid ahead. She could have asked, for example, Martin Shkreli. The former pharma executive became infamous after hiking the price of an HIV and malaria drug, and he became widely reviled last year. Shkreli, by the way, who is a real troll's troll, had some thoughts of his own on the EpiPen matter, saying about Mylan executives, quote, these guys are really vultures.
And he would know. He definitely would know.
He would. Speaking of vultures, one of the country's premier for-profit colleges looks on the verge of bankruptcy. ITT Tech said on its website that it's not currently signing up any more students, just days after the Department of Education said the school is ineligible for federal aid.
Oh, what a bummer.
In a blog post published on Thursday, Education Undersecretary Ted Mitchell said the company was being denied department-administered tuition assistance, quote, based on the operational and financial risk they pose to students and taxpayers. He also noted that ITT Tech is being looked into for fraudulent practices by multiple state and federal agencies, including the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. ITT students that are currently enrolled are being given the option to transfer their credits or continue their education. Undersecretary Mitchell said that students who don't will likely be eligible to discharge their federal loan obligations. The Debt Collective, a grassroots group that has organized demonstrations against department rules on discharges, warned students against transfer or continuing their ITT studies, advising them to withdraw immediately.
One of the few times when it is advisable to immediately drop out of school.
Do not take a teach out, said the Debt Collective in a statement posted over the weekend. Do not agree to transfer your credits to another sham school. Transferring credits could mean you will not get the discharge that you could get if ITT closes before you completed your program. For-profit colleges, by the way, are heavily subsidized by the U.S. government. Though regulations cap the share of for-profit colleges' federally financed revenue at an already high 90% of the company's overall income, in 2014, for example, the department reported that 27 different schools were breaking that threshold.
Jesus, that's not heavily subsidized. That's almost completely subsidized.
Yeah, right? Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is a prominent critic of for-profit colleges, cheered the move last Thursday on Twitter. She said, quote, ITT Tech's free ride is finally over and the message is clear. We won't stand by and allow these shady schools to cheat students and taxpayers. If ITT Tech does go bust, something that seems exceedingly likely in the wake of the regulatory action, it will be the second major for-profit college to go under in just over a year. In April 2015, Corinthian Colleges filed for bankruptcy amid similar regulatory scrutiny and a bevy of lawsuits filed by students over deceptive practices.
Yes, so pray for the private college industry. Actually, never mind, don't. They're awful. Don't pray for them. They should be shut down.
Yeah, pray for them maybe in like an Old Testament, like vengeful God kind of way.
Yeah, and I will say if this industry could be in big trouble if, I hate to say this, but if Hillary Clinton is elected and assuming she believes in her college affordability plan, which was largely ripped from Bernie Sanders and is able to implement that stuff, that could give people an alternative so that they don't have to go to the for-profit rackets to get their education. They'll have more access to public institutions that accredited.
Yeah. And I'll say this, especially with her opponent as Donald Trump, with the Trump University fiasco being a issue throughout the campaign. You know, advocates can always turn to Hillary Clinton and say, do you really want to preside over an industry that gives rise to Trump universities?
Yes, exactly.
I think we both know the answer that at least she has to give publicly there.
Yes, yes. Don't pray for the college industry, private college industry. Pray for the internet, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Save your prayers for online. Turning now from ITT Tech to just plain old tech. The FCC won't be challenging an appellate court's decision to declare its municipal broadband initiative illegal. The commission revealed the move to the New York Times in an article published on Sunday, saying that an appeal, quote, would not be the best use of commission resources. Early last year, in 2015, the FCC had announced the initiative, which centered on the preemption of state laws in Tennessee and North Carolina. Two states had prohibited the establishment or expansion of municipal broadband. The Times noted that the fight had been watched throughout the country by places that are considering their own municipally owned broadband, including big cities like LA, San Francisco, and Seattle. The FCC lost its battle over their municipal broadband rules earlier this month at the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals.
If I can just say, guaranteeing that everybody has access to high-speed quality internet and using the community and people to pull resources to make that a right seems like a perfect use of FCC resources. And, you know, we covered this issue when the FCC affirmed municipal broadband, and I thought that was as big of a decision as the net neutrality decision. Sure, you know, it's good to keep the internet open free, but you have to make sure people can access it as well.
Sure, sure. Well, I would say there are, you know, judiciary arcane things that, you know, maybe the Supreme Court wouldn't even take up the case. You know, you never know.
So we're running out of time for today's show. So let's go ahead and cram in a devil's advocate to close things out.
I agree with you, Bart.
What about both sides?
Well, you're only technically right.
Devil's advocate.
Okay, let's talk about Wiener. And you know what I mean by Wiener. This is a fundamentally a sad story, and it's likely about the breaking up of a marriage. As you know, Anthony Wiener, the former congressman, former candidate for New York mayor, and prolific photographer of his junk, has been caught once again sexting pictures of his junk to people who are not his wife being Huma Abedin, who happens to be Hillary Clinton's closest advisor. On Monday, in what was likely a bid to put the story to rest for a bit, Huma announced that she and Wiener were separating. Again, this is mostly a sad story about a relationship that's being torn apart. Most likely because of the husband's perverse online behavior. Of course, maybe they had an open relationship and what he was doing wasn't so bad. I don't know. I'll reserve most of the judgment here. But since this is devil's advocate, a time when we try our best to explain why bad things are actually good, let's explain why it's good that Wiener's Wiener is once again exposed. For one, it finally prompted Wiener to delete his Twitter account. His pinned tweet up until this latest iteration of the sexting scandal had lamented that it was too late for him to delete his account. I guess it wasn't. I guess he was wrong. He could have deleted his account at that time, but now it is. But hey, better late than never, I'd say, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I think so. Here's a second reason this is good. Kuma is single. That's good, right?
Yeah. I mean, am I right, gentlemen?
You wrote that, not me. But
you read it. You know, the scandals brought out another round of stellar headlines on the story, including the Daily Caller's Huma Cuts Off Wiener and New York Post's Pop Goes the Wiener. Those are always entertaining. One more here. Anthony is single. That's good. Am I right, ladies?
That's not so good, actually.
Yeah, you're probably right. That's not good, even for a devil's advocate. Anyways, that's going to do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website, www.districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to the show, and you can listen to all our shows downloaded onto your phone or iPad by searching for District Sentinel Radio. Stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C. so you don't have to be.